Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you four stories about lost and found culinary treasures.
We are searching for what will be lost, and we're trying to rejuvenate it.
What we try to do is collect these sourdoughs that contribute to the biodiversity of sourdough in order to store them, to document them, and be able to preserve them for the future.
It's bringing back the history and just being part of that time that just, there's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like it.
When fame comes late, I'm sure it's just as sweet as when it comes earlier.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we are going to be talking about what the Democratic candidates are saying about farm policy and agriculture in the United States. And with me on the line today is Leah Douglas. She is an associate editor and staff writer at FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network. I've been a big champion of theirs ever since they geared it up, I don't know how many years ago now. Prior to joining the team, she worked for 3 years as a reporter and policy analyst with the Open Markets Institute, where she researched economic consolidation and monopolization in the food and agriculture industry. She founded and wrote Food and Power, a first-of-its-kind resource on food sector consolidation. I got to check that out, Leah. And her writing on food, agriculture, and land policy has appeared in The Nation, The Washington Monthly, The Journal of Food Law and Policy, CNN, Fortune, Time, Slate, Daily Yonder, Civil Eats, and more. Leah has held a variety of jobs in the food system, including working on farms, co-running a CSA, and facilitating the development of rural food buying co-ops. Oh my God, what a CV, and you look like such a young thing. How did you get all this done already? I'm jealous. Leah, can you hear me?
Thanks for having me, Katie.
Oh, there you are. Okay. I missed that first thing, but anyway. So Leah, I called you because you attended the Heartland Forum in Iowa last month, which was organized by the Family Farmers Union. I want you to tell us all about that event because it was kind of exciting.
Yes, yeah, it was a great event. So yeah, the Heartland Forum happens in Storm Lake, Iowa, which is a rural small town in Iowa, and it was moderated by the town's Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the local paper, Art Cullen, and yep. Co-sponsored by Open Markets Action and the Iowa Farm Union, among other groups, and HuffPost was the media partner. So it was a really vibrant event. I traveled there on a bus with some farmers from the Wisconsin Farmers Union, many of whom had gotten up as early as 12:30 or 1 a.m. to get there.
Wow.
So there was some serious commitment from the crowd to attending the forum.
Mm-hmm. So who, first of all, why was the forum organized? What was it for? Was it just for Democratic candidates to show off that they care about farmers, or was there actually another agenda?
That was essentially the purpose. I think it was the idea was to have sort of the first opportunity for presidential hopefuls to really share their rural agenda and to share it in a place that is a rural community, as opposed to from a major city or many of the other places where later presidential debates will happen. So this was an opportunity for folks who live in this community and for farmers who are, you know, located in other parts of the Midwest and rural advocates from the area to be able to better access the candidates at this stage in their campaigns and to really hear for the first time what are some of the top issues that candidates will be talking about as they're rolling out their agriculture platforms.
Well, the fact that there is an agriculture platform is kind of a new thing in and of itself, don't you think? I mean, I don't remember that happening in the last cycle. I covered the politics for that pretty carefully myself because I kept hoping there would be something about food and agriculture, and somehow nobody ever really talked about it in any substantive way. So that was kind of a new thing in, just by itself, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it's really remarkable this year how early and how often several of the candidates are talking about agriculture and rural issues. I think there's more awareness, especially understanding how many communities in rural places in the country did go for President Trump And I think Democrats are really looking to unseat his popularity in some of those places, and also to speak to the 40% of rural voters who don't support President Trump. So I think there is some more motivation this cycle to really make it clear that Democrats are thinking about issues that stretch beyond the coast.
Oh, that's really nice. So one of the people that showed up at this was Elizabeth Warren, but who were the other ones?
Yes, so Elizabeth Warren was sort of the opening speaker, and she was followed joined by Julian Castro, the former Housing and Urban Development Secretary under Obama, John Delaney, who's a former Maryland congressman, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, and Ohio Representative Tim Ryan, who at the time had not announced his candidacy but has been. So the five of them were the participants in the forum.
Right. And so what was the message, essentially?
So messages varied, but I would say the takeaway that I had and that a lot of folks had was that antitrust enforcement was really the biggest issue, which is really interesting because I think a lot of rural advocates and farmers have spoken to the need for stronger antitrust enforcement, for better antitrust policy in the agriculture sector for a long time, for decades. But it's rarely sort of been a flashy policy arena. Very few people historically have really tried to push that issue to the forefront of voters' minds. But I think in the last few years, we've really seen a sea change where, especially as consolidation has reshaped basically every sector of the economy, and as consumers, we can see that more and more happening in our daily lives. The issue of antitrust has really risen in this campaign cycle, and more candidates are speaking to it. So Elizabeth Warren, when she rolled out her rural and agriculture platform in the days leading up to the forum, it was really an antitrust, predominantly an antitrust platform, talking about breaking up big mega mergers in the agriculture space, about the power that agribusiness has over small farmers and how farmers are being driven out of business as a result. So that was a really common theme throughout the speakers. Amy Klobuchar also discussed that issue. She's the ranking member on the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee, so has a lot of experience in that realm. And there were a couple other themes that arose from rural education access to broadband to addressing the flooding that's ongoing in the Midwest. But I would say that agribusiness and the power of agribusiness was really the dominant theme.
I think it's interesting that Amy Klobuchar, who comes from an ag state, and who's been in office for a while, is just now beginning to talk about this, don't you? I mean, that just makes me kind of mad, frankly.
Yes, I mean, I would say, you know, Amy Klobuchar did speak to it at the event, it's not as high on her list of priorities necessarily, or at least as she's expressed them so far, as it is for Elizabeth Warren. Warren also made an appearance there was a rally that preceded the forum that was hosted by a coalition of farm groups, and Warren also made an appearance there and really got the crowd excited about her ideas about breaking up big ag, which also dovetails with her economic policy priorities around big tech, for instance, where she's also put a lot of attention. So I think that she's really been dominating the conversation, and Amy Klobuchar has been joining in.
Uh-huh. And just what were her ideas for breaking up big ag? Because, you know, it's fine to talk about invoking antitrust laws, but so far nobody's had the sand to do it, and we certainly don't have an attorney general who's willing to pursue that. So what were her concepts? What did she say something that you hadn't heard before?
Sure. So her policy platform is pretty direct and aggressive, like many of her ideas around economic policy and the concentration of economic power. She's discussed unwinding the Bayer-Monsanto merger, which is an idea that I haven't heard other candidates necessarily articulate or back. She's talked about stronger enforcement of mergers and more proclivity to block mergers, and appointing folks to the regulatory agencies that oversee agribusiness mergers, who are more inclined to be critical or skeptical. And she talked about a national right to repair law, which is an issue that many folks don't know about, but that is a big deal in the farming community, where because just a couple of companies control the vast majority of farm equipment, they yeah. often have policies in which farmers have to go to one of their shops or, you know, approved repair people in order to have their equipment fixed, and farmers can't do it themselves on the farm, which is a relatively new concept. Many farmers have spent decades repairing their own equipment. So that's become a really major issue that is one of the ripple effects of consolidation in the sector. Right. So Warren added that into her platform, which is also something that, you know, is almost sort of a niche issue that, you know, I think farmers really appreciated that she was able to see that as an important thing to add.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. It sounds like she did her homework. So how did the crowd respond? What was the response? Were they enthusiastic, or was it kind of like, yeah, well, we've heard some of this before? Because, I mean, didn't the Obama administration basically say most of the same things when they swung through the Midwest in the first campaign cycle in 2008?
Yes. You know, candidate Barack Obama did make a lot of promises around better regulating large-scale livestock operations and addressing consolidation in agribusiness. And actually, throughout the Obama administration, there was an effort led by the Department of Justice and the Department of Agriculture to address some of the issues of consolidation that had come up that farmers were sort of repeatedly concerned about. And ultimately, that all those meetings that came from that work led nowhere. And many farmers, who, including farmers who attended this forum, participated in that process and had conversations with the Obama administration about the issue of consolidation and the power of agribusiness and how important it was to address. And, you know, remember that nothing happened. It's definitely a fresh memory. So I think that, you know, despite that, I think there's still, I saw, you know, a lot of optimism and energy. I think, you know, some folks are still withholding their commitments to any candidates because we're early in the process. But I think there is still some hope that maybe this time things can look different and that the Democratic candidate will maybe understand that given what happened under Obama, that this is sort of a second chance opportunity. I spoke to one farmer who said, you know, if they mess it up this time, you know, there's going to be a backlash to that. So I think that folks were still eager to hear the message and were excited about antitrust sort of taking center stage. And I think also are, you know, aware that we've been down this path before.
Right, right. And I guess it's too early to say if there were any Republicans who were sharing that message. But do you have, with your ear to the ground, do you hear of any Republicans who are, you know, speaking similarly about breaking up big agriculture, or they, you know, think that big agriculture is just fine and it's working just great, as Thomas Massey from Kentucky told me?
You know, I haven't heard really any Republican candidates jumping onto this particular type of messaging. But, you know, we'll have another year or so to see if anyone emerges.
Right, because it's certainly, I mean, I don't hear even Sonny Perdue saying anything about this. And why would he, of course? It sounds like you're not sure that the Trump administration has reached its wall in terms of these voters. In other words, they're not ready to jump ship yet. They're still kind of waiting and seeing. It's not a done deal for them. Because, I mean, given the trade policies and all of the other stuff that's happened, if I had supported Trump in the first cycle, I certainly would not be prepared to support him again. But what was your sense?
Well, sure. I think, you know, many of the farmers at the forum weren't necessarily Trump voters. So either they had supported a Democrat, at least some of the farmers that I met supported a Democrat in the last election. But from what they said around organizing their communities that might be a little bit more politically diverse, you know, I think that there's still work to be done. I think that, you know, particularly the ongoing trade war has really depressed prices for a certain type of farmer who sells into the export market. And also the situation in the dairy industry has become so dire that I think that there's really sort of historic alliances being made in that sector across party lines, across size of farm, where folks are really just noticing, you know, we're reaching a point where we can't really afford to have these same battle lines anymore. We have to try to figure out a way to work together. So I think it will be interesting to see how that perspective and how the sort of dire state of the farm economy translates into votes, because I think there is an opportunity, at least from what I heard from organizers in Iowa, that they see an opportunity to try to get some of those folks who feel disillusioned or feel that something needs to change. So I think that there's, you know, definitely folks who are still on the fence or waiting to hear more. But I would say that the reaction at the forum was generally positive to the ideas that those set of Democrats were presenting.
Right, right. Now, you know, aside from the idea of unwinding the Bayer-Monsanto merger, and, you know, to be honest with me, that seems, you know, it's like the cow is already out of the barn. Like, how do you unwind something like that? And what about the ones that preceded it, the Dow, DuPont, the, you know, Syngenta, ChemChina, not that those are American companies, but still, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know how you back that, one into something where that you can actually force these companies to, you know, make that change. I don't understand how that would work. Do you?
You know, Elizabeth Warren hasn't announced any specifics of technically how it would work. So I also don't know how it would work.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. And what about other things like, well, we're going to get into those in a minute, but you've been writing about consolidation for quite a while. And obviously it's, you know, as your bio indicates, it's been a big source of interest for you. Well, what do you think it will take to break up these monopolies? I mean, never mind what Elizabeth Warren thinks, but I mean, what do you think it will take? Is it just lawsuits, enforcing antitrust? Is it, I don't know. You tell me. What is the answer?
Sure. No pressure.
Yeah. What's your prescription for fixing the food system, Leah? Right. No, but I mean, seriously, as somebody who's really covered this for a long time, like, what do you think is the answer or one of the answers?
Definitely. I think there's a few ways to look at it, and the focus of my work has really been, especially in the last couple of years, on sort of what I call the ripple effects of consolidation. So we have the sort of technical machinery of consolidation, which looks like mergers and acquisitions and the regulatory process that happens at the federal level to oversee those mergers and acquisitions, which is our antitrust, you know, our sort of, when you think about antitrust law, that's kind of the federal level enforcement. But a lot of what I write about is what's kind of happening in communities that are affected by highly consolidated industries, whether it's the emergence of factory farms in many states that didn't used to have large-scale industrial agriculture, and the environmental impacts of that on people's health, on water and air, or looking at job losses as a result of mergers and acquisitions, or right. How the agribusiness industry has used its political power to change the laws at the state and federal level because they've accumulated more and more power as the companies have become more and more, have eclipsed smaller competitors, and the market share is split between just two or three companies in several sectors. So I think that given that sort of wide scope of impacts, there's a lot of different policy changes that could be made that would ameliorate some of the harm that's done by this ongoing consolidation. So, you know, on the preventative end, you have, you know, some of the federal enforcement issues that, for instance, Warren was talking about having regulators and judges who are, you know, not necessarily going to rubber stamp any merger that comes across the table.
Right.
There's also things that can be done at the state level, and that certainly state and local advocates are working on around the clock, like making it harder to permit large-scale industrial animal farm operations, or enhancing local control over how land is used or zoning, things like that, that are sort of more in the nitty-gritty of local legislation that has a lot of impact on how communities actually deal with the changing face of the farm economy. And then there's also the piece about addressing the market as it is. You know, as you said, it's not entirely clear right away what it would take to sort of unwind these mergers that have happened, especially those that are even more entrenched than the Bayer-Monsanto merger, which was just completed last year. So I think there's also pieces around our regulations around farm pollutants, whether it's manure or other types of waste that the agribusiness industry has really successfully deregulated that sector, and how those pollutants are managed, or addressing the power of co-ops, for instance, that have departed from their original intent as, you know, entities that serve the farmer. So right. I think that there's things that you can sort of do on the side of addressing how these companies operate now and what their impact is on our political ecosystem that could also marry sort of the preventative elements.
Absolutely. That was a great answer, by the way. You rose to the challenge extremely well. We're going to take a real short break, and I mean very short break, and we'll be right back with Leah Douglas from the Food and Environment Reporting Network. We're talking about what the Democratic candidates are saying about how to manage the farm economy going forward. So stay tuned.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk combined with expertise in affinage is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Do you love this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. We have over 35,000 shows in our online library. My name is Jennifer Leutze, and I'm the host of Tech Bites, where we talk to innovators and influencers in the food tech space. You can find Tech Bites wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back. So you recently, as an example of consolidation in agriculture, let's talk about the piece that you just published in partnership with the Oregonian about the mega dairy that went belly up in Oregon, leaving such a disastrous mess that the state is now considering a moratorium on allowing any more mega dairies to locate in Oregon. So tell us a little bit about that situation. What happened? And why did that company go belly up? I'm blanking on that right now.
Sure. So the farm that I wrote about for the Oregonian is called Lost Valley Farm, and it was a dairy CAFO, which is basically a large-scale animal operation that housed about 15,000 cows and in Boardman, Oregon. And it was opened in 2017, despite the fact that there was a lot of community resistance from people who live in Oregon against the opening of this CAFO. And it was the second largest dairy operation in the state, and it was sourcing the Tillamook dairy operation, which makes Tillamook cheese, which many of us have seen in the grocery store. And it was sort of a tortured process from the start to get this dairy approved. The owner was missing some of his water permits, and it was, state officials were sort of attempting to fast-track his approval process. And ultimately, the farm just wasn't managed well enough to handle particularly the manure that was created by all these tens of thousands of cows. So as a result, fairly quickly, there were spillages and other types of, runoff issues that were stemming from the manure that was being mismanaged. And the farm just started racking up fines from state regulators and eventually was shuttered as a result of this mismanagement. So it was shut down and sold just this past couple of months. So what I wrote about in my story for the Oregonian was this sort of whole boondoggle spurred a conversation in the state about whether to just block to have a moratorium on any more similar operations. And Oregon kind of sits in an interesting place in terms of its penetration of CAFO is because it's not necessarily a state that has fully shifted its dairy production, for instance, into large-scale mega farms. There's still only like a couple farms that look like that in the state, and there's still a fairly high number of small to medium-sized dairy farms. So it's a little bit in sort of a decision-making process about, which sort of direction do we want to send the dairy industry? And so that is the sort of opportunity that some advocates are taking to say we should, stop allowing these permits for farms that look like this and we should, you know, reconsider our permitting process. So that's that bill that would issue that moratorium is currently being considered by the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's back up for a second about this. Now, you said in the story that the state regulators essentially fast-tracked this guy's permits. They were very anxious to let him start running this business. What is it, economically speaking, what is it that would have made them so eager to let somebody build a facility like this, especially in light of the local community pushback? What are they gaining by that, by having done that?
That's a great question. I think that there's an economic component. I mean, I think the state's dairy industry is pretty powerful. When I was researching the piece, I found a statistic that just milk production in the state in 2017 totaled about $500 million. So, you know, that's not necessarily small potatoes, especially given, you know, Oregon's sort of, as I said, you know, it's in this transitional place where it's deciding, you know, how and whether to compete with other states in dairy. So that's one element that could have been contributing. I also noted in my piece that the agriculture industry is a big political contributor in the state of Oregon. You know, the biggest dairy in the state has donated over $200,000 to candidates since 2006. And the Oregonian actually had done a big project earlier in the year on Oregon's sort of uniquely lax regulations on corporate donations, and is actually, right. Oregon is actually the top country in the state in per capita corporate money donations in politics, which is, you know, surprising to me because of Oregon's sort of, I guess, now outdated reputation as kind of a green state. So there is like also a political donation element that could be in part of the ecosystem of the decision-making process.
Oh yeah, I would. I think we could safely assume that. But I just, you know, in the wake of the sort of all of the reporting that has come out just in the last few years about one, the disastrous failure of industry, whether it's the dairy industry or the animal agricultural industry at large, to manage their effluent. That in and of itself would be a bit of a deterrent. I mean, I know you said that they had donated something like $200,000, but that's over a long period of time, so it's not even that much money. And that's the thing that really struck me about your story was, like, we're not talking about millions of dollars here being donated to political parties. We're talking about pretty much chump change, especially over the course of, you know, roughly 13, 14 years. And I just found it really peculiar that these people are so out of touch with the reality of what these companies do when they move into a community and they build these lagoons and the impact on local waterways and basically quality of life. And I find it very curious that they have such a blind eye to this. What do you think accounts for that?
You know, it's hard to say, and as a non-Oregon resident, you know, I'm not as up on the local politics as, you know, certainly I think there are folks in the state who would have a much better understanding of, particularly for the state of Oregon, why that's happening. I did find it kind of striking that the site that Lost Valley Farm was sitting on was actually already a site that the Department of Environmental Quality, the state environmental regulator, had already given a special designation because of nitrate pollution, and nitrates are common farm pollutant. So I did find it kind of curious that on that site that, you know, has for years been identified as an area where the groundwater is somewhat polluted, that right. there was then approved a major polluting operation was very curious to me.
Yeah, very strange. I mean, the last couple of shows I've done have been about communities trying to organize pushback against CAFOs. That's why I'm asking you these questions about this, because, you know, it stuns me that these, you know, the people who are supposedly in charge of taking care of the population's well-being, essentially, you know, for a few bucks, you know, thrown their way for their next political campaign, are willing to throw the entire community under the bus, including themselves and their own families. I mean, they live there. They got to drink that water. They got to breathe that air. You know, it's just, it's mind blowing to me. But, you know, because I mean, to move on to the next, my next question is, you know, every state basically that has allowed CAFOs, you know, to proliferate in their states has seen a major loss of family farms, which has obviously tremendous economic implications. And then it's also coupled with this significant air and water pollution. And yet somehow the industry has managed to stave off any meaningful regulation, especially about managing effluent. I mean, talk about externalizing your costs absolutely brilliantly. It's just, it's really blows my mind. It makes me almost incoherent with rage, actually, as you can probably tell. But do you have a sense that the communities, that people are, you know, starting to wake up and smell the turds in the air? I mean, are there more organized, is there more organizing going on that you feel is kind of a groundswell, or is it just sort of these little pockets of people feebly trying to organize and failing to, you know, get their state regulators to do the right thing?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, I think that there is just an enormous amount of community labor and organizing that's going into really pushing back on this direction that the agriculture industry is headed. And certainly in the span of my relatively short career compared to the many of these organizers and advocates who have been working on this issue for decades, I've seen a larger and larger number of, you know, communities who at from the smallest level to the state level are really working on campaigns and working on organizing their communities across party lines and across difference to really push against particularly these large scale animal operations that can have such a dramatic negative impact on people's health and quality of life. So, you know, I think that there is a lot of energy to push against that. And I think that, you know, it's, there have been some victories at the state level, at the local level of moving, pushing back against new CAFOs. And we're seeing sort of a series of legal victories that the plaintiffs in North Carolina are winning against Smithfield as a result of, you know, the mismanagement of hog operations in North Carolina, which is giving people a lot of hope and energy, I think. So there is, I think, as the situation, you know, unfortunately sort of continues to get worse or go down the status quo path, I think that there is more and more resistance against it.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. I mean, I, you know, I hope that's true. I sit in my little perch and I interview, I follow all these news stories and then I interview locals. You know, I've been talking to people in Iowa. I've been talking to people in North Carolina. So I know that there's a lot of activity around it. It's just hard to sense how much community involvement there is. You know, there's always like a few hundred people who are really passionate about it. And then the rest of the people are just kind of like, yeah, well, you know, it is what it is. Or, you know, they think that it brings employment to the area, which it generally speaking does not do, because CAFOs don't tend to employ a lot of people. So, again, I thought it was odd that, you know, in your story about this dairy operation that, you know, was given a free pass, essentially, that they saw that as an economic opportunity for the community when really, you know, those kinds of big milking barns don't employ a lot of people that I'm aware of. I could certainly be wrong. I'm not an expert, but that's just been my experience. I want to ask another question about dairy farms, though, because, you know, I did a long series of programs last year about dairy, maybe 8 or 10 of them. And I talked to a lot of economists and farmers and you know, the problem with dairy appears to be that there is a giant glut on the market of milk and we don't regulate our supply. And what I find so interesting about that is that it has, I mean, of course, it's decimated the dairy community because it has made the prices go down so low that it doesn't, they don't even cover the cost of production, as I'm sure you know. And when states allow that kind of big dairy operation to come in, it's like they are ignoring that economic aspect of it, that if you have 15,000 cows in one place, you're going to produce so much milk that all the other guys can't possibly compete against that. And I don't understand why farmers are not organizing to generate more support for regulating the supply. What do you think about that? Why is that not happening?
Well, I would actually note that in my experience, it is happening, which maybe is welcome news. And I've done some reporting on supply management, which you alluded to, which is basically a policy system in which we would have national a marketplace and a structured marketplace in which there's a limit on how much of each commodity supply is sort of in circulation. And this is how Canada, for instance, manages its milk supply, and actually used to be how the U.S. managed many of our commodity supplies. So it's actually not a foreign concept. It used to be sort of status quo for how our U.S. farm economy operated. And that's definitely become a more and more palatable or exciting idea to dairy farmers that I've spoken to. I think even just a couple years ago, it was something that was too radical to really even have a conversation about. But now there's sort of national farmer convenings that are talking about or voting on supply management as, you know, whether they want to take that on as a policy priority. There's actually a new organizing campaign out of the Wisconsin Farmers Union that's called Dairy Together that is attempting to unite dairy farmers from really across the country, spanning all the way from the Northeast to California, to talk about what type of federal or national milk policy could put dairy farmers in a better position, whether that's supply management, which is one of the ideas in the running, or some other type of restructuring of the market. So there's a lot of really active conversation in that space. I think that there's a lot of, as I said earlier, just urgency from farmers. I mean, Wisconsin, for instance, you know, the dairy capital of the country is losing up to 2 dairy farms at each day. And that's been going on for years. I mean, it's really staggering, the amount of farm loss that we're experiencing. So I think, again, as that situation has gotten worse and worse, and, you know, certainly the Department of Agriculture has not introduced any novel ideas about how to manage it, and Congress has also not introduced or had much success with any novel ideas, I think that many farmers are taking it on as sort of their own issue to try to address and to build some support in the farming community around these new ideas.
Yeah, I know. It would be nice to see that happen. I feel like in this case, Congress and the Department of Agriculture have lagged way behind the realities. And that goes right back to the Obama administration. I mean, I didn't see Tom Vilsack trying to introduce any legislation that would have or encourage legislators to develop any legislation that would encourage supply management. And I would also add that Tom Vilsack went right through into the through the revolving door and is now, you know, shilling for the dairy industry abroad and trying to sell more milk abroad rather than trying to address the problems on the ground. And I think that's kind of sad and ironic as well. Where would this, I mean, if legislators were to get behind this, and this will be my last question, if legislators were to get behind this, where would that come from? Would that come from, you know, the senators or the congressmen from dairy or agricultural states, or would it come from the U.S. Department of Agriculture? Who would be sort of the point person if, say, our government actually, you know, got its act together and did something constructive for farmers in the country?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that certainly, you know, some of the bolder proposals or more active conversations have happened in Congress. I think there are specific members of Congress who are really up to speed on this issue. For instance, another presidential candidate, Kirsten Gillibrand, has been involved in the dairy sector because New York State has a dairy industry that's quite large, and she has proposed various types of not necessarily a supply management system, but just other types of ways to address the dairy crisis that's ongoing and has been for years. So there are members of Congress who are engaged on the issue. I think any type of next step would necessarily involve the Department of Agriculture because milk pricing, the way it's organized, does run through the Department of Agriculture. But I would personally be surprised if, especially under the Trump administration, any major policy proposals that shifted how we thought about dairy production would come out of the Department of Agriculture per se, though cooperation would be necessary just because of how the milk market is structured and how milk prices are set. So I think probably I'd be looking towards Congress and even towards state legislators just for novel ideas and ultimately to the farming community, which will be generating all of those ideas and proposals.
Right, right. Well, Leah, thank you so much for this. I really, I so appreciate your time. I think I've got everything here. Yes, I do. I've covered all of my questions, and now is your moment to shamelessly promote yourself and your organization. So go.
Okay, great. Well, please follow the Food and Environment Reporting Network. We're at thefern.org or online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, whatever your preferred platforms are. You can follow me on Twitter at Leah J. Douglas or find my work online at my website, leahjdouglas.com. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. I hope you'll come back. Honestly, you were just absolutely terrific. I really appreciate it. It was a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And
anytime.
Thank you to my... Oh, sorry. I'm good. I'm glad you had a good time. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to say thank you for telling me how great my questions were. I really love that. Ever needy. Ever needy. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Thanks to my sponsor and thanks, Matt, for helping me out with this yet again. We'll see you next week with another great show. So long for now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.